With capital punishment in the offing, how can Gulliver escape the land of Lilliput? Jonathan Swift, today on the Classic Tales Podcast. Welcome to the Classic Tales Podcast. Thank you for listening. The vintage episode for the week is The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster. Be sure to check out this science fiction classic on Tuesday. If you enjoy the show, please become a monthly supporter and help us continue to highlight these amazing stories. Please go to ClassicTalesAudiobooks.com and become a monthly supporter for as little as $5 a month. As a thank you gesture, we'll send you a coupon code every month for $8 off any audiobook order. Give more and you get more. It's a great way to help us keep producing sparkling audiobook content. Go to ClassicTalesAudiobooks.com and become a supporter today. And now, A Voyage to Lilliput, Part 3 of 3, from Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. Chapter 6. Of the Inhabitants of Lilliput, Their Learning, Laws, and Customs, The Manner of Educating Their Children, The Author's Way of Living in That Country, His Vindication of a Great Lady. Although I intend to leave the description of this empire to a particular treatise, yet in the meantime, I am content to gratify the curious reader with some general ideas. As the common size of the natives is somewhat under 6 inches high, there is an exact proportion in all other animals, as well as plants and trees. For instance, the tallest horses and oxen are between 4 and 5 inches in height, the sheep 1.5 inches, more or less, their geese about the bigness of a sparrow, and so the several gradations downwards, till you come to the smallest, which, to my sight, were almost invisible. But nature has adapted the eyes of the Lilliputians to all objects proper for their view. They see with great exactness, but at no great distance. And to show the sharpness of their sight towards objects that are near, I have been much pleased with observing a cook pulling a lark, which was not so large as a common fly, and a young girl threading an invisible needle with invisible silk. Their tallest trees are about 7 feet high. I mean some of those in the great royal park, the tops whereof I could but just reach with my fist clenched. The other vegetables are in the same proportion, but this I leave to the reader's imagination. I shall say but little at present of their learning, which for many ages has flourished in all its branches among them. But their manner of writing is very peculiar, being neither from the left to the right like the Europeans, nor from the right to the left like the Arabians, nor from up to down like the Chinese, but aslant, from one corner of the paper to the other, like ladies in England. They bury their dead with their heads directly downward, because they hold an opinion that in 11,000 moons they are all to rise again, in which period the earth, which they conceive to be flat, will turn upside down, and by this means they shall, at their resurrection, be found ready standing on their feet. The learned among them confess the absurdity of this doctrine, but the practice still continues in compliance to the vulgar. There are some laws and customs in this empire very peculiar, and if they were not so directly contrary to those of my own dear country, I should be tempted to say a little in their justification. It is only to be wished they were as well executed. The first I shall mention relates to informers. All crimes against the state are punished here with the utmost severity. But, if the person accused makes his innocence plainly to appear upon his trial, the accuser is immediately put to an ignominious death, and out of his goods or lands the innocent person is quadruply recompensed for the loss of his time, for the danger he underwent, for the hardship of his imprisonment, and for all the charges he has been at in making his defense, or, if that fund be deficient, it is largely supplied by the crown. The emperor also confers on him some public mark of his favor, and proclamation is made of his innocence through the whole city. They look upon fraud as a greater crime than theft, and therefore seldom fail to punish it with death, for they allege that care and vigilance, with a very common understanding, may preserve a man's goods from thieves, but honesty has no defense against superior cunning. And, since it is necessary that there should be a perpetual intercourse of buying and selling and dealing upon credit, where fraud is permitted and connived at, or has no law to punish it, the honest dealer is always undone, and the knave gets the advantage. I remember when I was once interceding with the emperor for a criminal who had wronged his master of a great sum of money, which he had received by order and ran away with, and happening to tell his majesty, by way of extenuation, that it was only a breach of trust, the emperor thought it monstrous in me to offer as a defense the greatest aggravation of the crime. And I truly had little to say in return, farther than the common answer, that different nations had different customs, for I confess I was heartily ashamed. Although we usually call reward and punishment the two hinges upon which all government turns, yet I could never observe this maxim to be put in practice by any nation except that of Lilliput. Whoever can there bring sufficient proof that he has strictly observed the laws of his country for 73 moons, has a claim to certain privileges, according to his quality or condition of life, with a proportionable sum of money out of a fund appropriated for that use. He likewise acquires the title of Snilpaul, or legal, which is added to his name, but does not descend to his posterity. And these people thought it a prodigious defect of policy among us, when I told them that our laws were enforced only by penalties, without any mention of reward. It is upon this account that the image of justice in their courts of judicature is formed with 6 eyes, 2 before, as many behind, and 1 on each side, to signify circumspection, with a bag of gold open in her right hand and a sword sheathed in her left, to show she is more disposed to reward than to punish. In choosing persons for all employments, they have more regard to good morals than to great abilities. For since government is necessary to mankind, they believe that the common size of human understanding is fitted to some station or other, and that Providence never intended to make the management of public affairs a mystery to be comprehended only by a few persons of sublime genius, of which there seldom are 3 born in an age. But they suppose truth, justice, temperance, and the like, to be in every man's power, the practice of which virtues, assisted by experience and a good intention, would qualify any man for the service of his country, except where a course of study is required. But they thought the want of moral virtues was so far from being supplied by superior endowments of the mind that employments could never be put into such dangerous hands as those of persons so qualified, and at least that the mistakes committed by ignorance in a virtuous disposition would never be of such fatal consequence to the public weal as the practices of a man whose inclinations led him to be corrupt and who had great abilities to manage, to multiply and defend his corruptions. In like manner, the disbelief of a divine providence renders a man incapable of holding any public station. For, since kings avow themselves to be the deputies of providence, the Lilliputians think nothing can be more absurd than for a prince to employ such men as disown the authority under which he acts. In relating these and the following laws, I would only be understood to mean the original institutions, and not the most scandalous corruptions, into which these people are fallen by the degenerate nature of man. For as to that infamous practice of acquiring great employments by dancing on the ropes, or badges of favor and distinction by leaping over sticks and creeping under them, the reader is to observe that they were first introduced by the grandfather of the emperor now reigning, and grew to the present height by the gradual increase of party and faction. Ingratitude is among them a capital crime, as we read it to have been in some other countries. For they reason thus, that whoever makes ill returns to his benefactor must needs be a common enemy to the rest of mankind, for whom he has received no obligation, and therefore such a man is not fit to live. their notions relating to the duties of parents and children differ extremely from ours. For, since the conjunction of male and female is founded upon the great law of nature, in order to propagate and continue the species, the Lilliputians will needs have it that men and women are joined together, like other animals, by the motives of concupiscence, and that their tenderness towards their young proceeds from the like natural principle. For which reason, they will never allow that a child is under any obligation to his father for begetting him, or to his mother for bringing him into the world, which, considering the miseries of human life, was neither a benefit in itself, nor intended so by his parents, whose thoughts, in their love encounters, were otherwise employed. Upon these, and the like reasonings, their opinion is that parents are the last of all others to be trusted with the education of their own children, and therefore they have in every town public nurseries, where all parents, except cottagers and laborers, are obliged to send their infants of both sexes to be reared and educated. When they come to the age of 20 moons, at which time they are supposed to have some rudiments of docility. These schools are of several kinds, suited to different qualities, and both sexes. They have certain professors well skilled in preparing children for such a condition of life as befits the rank of their parents, and their own capacities, as well as inclinations. I shall first say something of the male nurseries, and then of the female. The nurseries for males of noble or eminent birth are provided with grave and learned professors and their several deputies. The clothes and food of the children are plain and simple. They are bred up in the principles of honor, justice, courage, modesty, clemency, religion, and love of their country. They are always employed in some business, except in the times of eating and sleeping, which are very short, and 2 hours for diversions consisting of bodily exercises. They are dressed by men till 4 years of age, and then are obliged to dress themselves, although their quality be ever so great, and the women attendant, who are aged proportionably to ours at 50, perform only the most menial offices. They are never suffered to converse with servants, but go together in smaller or greater numbers to take their diversions, and always in the presence of a professor, or one of his deputies, whereby they avoid those early bad impressions of folly and vice to which our children are subject. Their parents are suffered to see them only 2x a year. The visit is to last but an hour. They are allowed to kiss the child at meeting and parting, but a professor, who always stands by on those occasions, will not suffer them to whisper or use any fondling expressions, or bring any presents of toys, sweetmeats, and the like. The pension from each family for the education and entertainment of a child, upon failure of due payment, is levied by the emperor's officers. The nurseries for children of ordinary gentlemen, merchants, traders, and handicrafts are managed proportionably after the same manner, only those designed for trades are put out apprentices at 11 years old, whereas those of persons of quality continue in their exercises till 15, which answers to 21 with us. But the confinement is gradually lessened for the last 3 years. In the female nurseries, the young girls of quality are educated much like the males, only they are dressed by orderly servants of their own sex, but always in the presence of a professor or deputy, till they come to dress themselves, which is at 5 years old. And if it be found that these nurses ever presume to entertain the girls with frightful or foolish stories, or the common follies practiced by chambermaids among us, they are publicly whipped 2x about the city, imprisoned for 1 year, and banished for life to the most desolate part of the country. Thus the young ladies are as much ashamed of being cowards and fools as the men, and despise all personal ornaments beyond decency and cleanliness. Neither did I perceive any difference in their education made by their difference of sex, only that the exercises of the females were not altogether so robust, and that some rules were given them relating to domestic life, and a smaller compass of learning was enjoined them. For their maxim is that among peoples of quality, a wife should be always a reasonable and agreeable companion, because she cannot always be young. When the girls are 12 years old, which among them is a marriageable age, their parents or guardians take them home, with great expressions of gratitude to the professors, and seldom without tears of the young lady and her companions. In the nurseries of females of the meaner sort, the children are instructed in all kinds of works proper for their sex, and there are several degrees. Those intended for apprentices are dismissed at 7 years old. The rest are kept to 11. The meaner families who have children at these nurseries are obliged, besides their annual pension, which is as low as possible, to return to the steward of the nursery a small monthly share of their gettings, to be apportioned for the child, and therefore all parents are limited in their expenses by the law. For the Lilliputians think nothing can be more unjust than for people, in subservience to their own appetites, to bring children into the world and leave the burden of supporting them on the public. As to persons of quality, they give security to appropriate a certain sum for each child, suitable to their condition. And these funds are always managed with good husbandry and the most exact justice. The cottagers and laborers keep their children at home, their business being only to till and cultivate the earth, and therefore their education is of little consequence to the public. But the old and diseased among them are supported by hospitals, for begging is a trade unknown in this empire. And here it may perhaps divert the curious reader to give some account of my own domestics and my manner of living in this country during a residence of 9 months and 13 days, having a head mechanically turned and being likewise forced by necessity. I had made for myself a table and chair convenient enough, out of the largest trees in the royal park. 200 seamstresses were employed to make me shirts, and linen for my bed and table, all of the strongest and coarsest kind they could get, which, however, they were forced to quilt together in several folds, for the thickest was some degrees finer than lawn. Their linen is usually 3 inches wide, and 3 feet make a piece. The seamstresses took my measure as I lay on the ground, one standing at my neck and another at my mid-leg, with a strong cord extended, that each held by the end, while a third measured the length of the cord with a rule of 1 inch long. They then measured my right thumb, and desired no more, for by a mathematical computation, that twice round the thumb is once round the wrist, and so on to the neck and the waist, and by the help of my old shirt, which I displayed on the ground before them for a pattern, they fitted me exactly. 300 tailors were employed in the same manner to make me clothes, but they had another contrivance for taking my measure. I kneeled down, and they raised a ladder from the ground to my neck. Upon this ladder one of them mounted, and let fall a plumb line from my collar to the floor, which just answered the length of my coat. But my waist and arms I measured myself. When my clothes were finished, which was done in my house, for the largest of theirs would not have been able to hold them, they looked like the patchwork made by the ladies in England, only that mine were all of a color. I had 300 cooks to dress my victuals, in little convenient huts built about my house, where they and their families lived, and prepared me 2 dishes apiece. I took up 20 waiters in my hand and placed them on the table. 100 more attended below on the ground, some with dishes of meat, and some with barrels of wine and other liquors, slung on their shoulders, all which the waiters above drew up, as I wanted, in a very ingenious manner by certain cords, as we draw the bucket up a well in Europe. A dish of their meat was a good mouthful, and a barrel of their liquor a reasonable draught. Their mutton yields to ours, but their beef is excellent. I have had a sirloin so large that I have been forced to make 3 bites of it, but this is rare. My servants were astonished to see me eat it, bones and all, as in our country we do the leg of a lark. Their geese and turkeys I usually ate at a mouthful, and I confess they far exceeded ours. Of their smaller fowl, I could take up 20 or 30 at the end of my knife. One day, His Imperial Majesty, being informed of my way of living, desired that himself and his royal consort, with the young princes of the blood of both sexes, might have the happiness, as he was pleased to call it, of dining with me. They came accordingly, and I placed them in chairs of state, upon my table, just over against me, with their guards about them. Flimnap, the Lord High Treasurer, attended there likewise with his white staff, and I observed he looked on me with a sour countenance, which I would not seem to regard, but ate more than usual, in honor to my dear country, as well as to fill the court with admiration. I have some private reasons to believe that this visit from His Majesty gave Flimnap an opportunity of doing me ill offices to his master. That minister had always been my secret enemy, though he outwardly caressed me more than was usual to the moroseness of his nature. He represented to the emperor the low condition of his treasury, that he was forced to take up money at a great discount, that exchequer bills would not circulate under 9%, below par, that I had cost His Majesty above 1.5 million sprugs, their greatest gold coin, about the bigness of a spangle, and upon the whole, that it would be advisable in the emperor to take the first fair occasion of dismissing me. I am here obliged to vindicate the reputation of an excellent lady, who was an innocent sufferer upon my account. The treasurer took a fancy to be jealous of his wife, from the malice of some evil tongues, who informed him that her grace had taken a violent affection for my person, and the court scandal ran for some time, that she once came privately to my lodging. This I solemnly declare to be a most infamous falsehood, without any grounds, further than that her grace was pleased to treat me with all innocent marks of freedom and friendship. I own she came often to my house, but always publicly, nor ever without three more in the coach, who were usually her sister and young daughter, and some particular acquaintance, but this was common to many other ladies of the court. And I still appeal to my servants round, whether they at any time saw a coach at my door without knowing what persons were in it. On those occasions, when a servant had given me notice, my custom was to go immediately to the door, and after paying my respects, to take up the coach and two horses very carefully in my hands, for there were six horses, the postilion always unharnessed four, and place them on a table, where I had fixed a movable rim quite round of 5 inches high to prevent accidents. And I have often had four coaches and horses at once on my table, full of company, while I sat in my chair, leaning my face towards them. And when I was engaged with one set, the coachman would gently drive the others round my table. I have passed many an afternoon very agreeably in these conversations. But I defy the treasurer, or his two informers, I will name them, and let them make the best of it, Clustrel and Drunlow, to prove that any person ever came to me incognito, except the Secretary Reldrassal, who was sent by express command of His Imperial Majesty, as I have before related. I should not have dwelt so long upon this particular, if it had not been a point wherein the reputation of a great lady is so nearly concerned, to say nothing of my own, though I had then the honor to be a Nardac, which the treasurer himself is not, for all the world knows that he is only a Glumglum, a title inferior by one degree, as that of a marquis is to a duke in England, yet I allow he preceded me in right of his post. These false informations, which I afterwards came to knowledge of by an accident not proper to mention, made the treasurer show his lady for some time an ill countenance, and me a worse. And although he was at last undeceived and reconciled to her, yet I lost all credit with him, and found my interest decline very fast with the emperor himself, who was indeed too much governed by that favorite. Chapter 7. The author, being informed of a design to accuse him of high treason, makes his escape to Blefuscu, his reception there. Before I proceed to give an account of my leaving this kingdom, it may be proper to inform the reader of a private intrigue which had been for 2 months forming against me. I had been hitherto, all my life, a stranger to courts, for which I was unqualified by the meanness of my condition. I had indeed heard and read enough of the dispositions of great princes and ministers, but never expected to have found such terrible effects of them in so remote a country, governed, as I thought, by very different maxims from those in Europe. When I was just preparing to pay my attendance on the Emperor of Blefuscu, a considerable person at court, to whom I had been very serviceable, at a time when he lay under the highest displeasure of His Imperial Majesty, came to my house very privately at night, in a close chair, and without sending his name, desired admittance. The chairmen were dismissed. I put the chair, with his lordship in it, into my coat pocket, and giving orders to a trusty servant to say I was indisposed and gone to sleep, I fastened the door of my house, placed the chair on the table, according to my usual custom, and sat down by it. After the common salutations were over, observing his lordship's countenance full of concern, and inquiring into the reason, he desired I would hear him with patience, in a matter that highly concerned my honor and my life. His speech was to the following effect, for I took notes of it as soon as he left me. "You are to know," said he, "that several committees of council have been lately called, in the most private matter, on your account, and it is but 2 days since His Majesty came to a full resolution. You are very sensible that Skyrish Bolgolum, Galbet, or High Admiral, has been your mortal enemy almost ever since your arrival. His original reasons I know not, but his hatred is increased since your great success against Blefuscu, by which his glory as admiral is much obscured. This lord, in conjunction with Flimnap the High Treasurer, whose enmity against you is notorious on account of his lady, Limtok the General, Lalcon the Chamberlain, and Balmuff the Great Justiciary, have prepared articles of impeachment against you for treason and other capital crimes." This preface made me so impatient, being conscious of my own merits and innocence, that I was going to interrupt him, when he entreated me to be silent, and thus proceeded. "Out of gratitude for the favors you have done me, I have procured information of the whole proceedings, and a copy of the articles, wherein I venture my head for your service. Articles of impeachment against Quinbus Flestrin, the Man Mountain. Article 1. Whereas, by a statute made in the reign of His Imperial Majesty Calendifar Plun, it is enacted that whoever shall make water within the precincts of the royal palace shall be liable to the pains and penalties of high treason. Notwithstanding, the said Quintus Flestrin, in open breach of the said law, under color of extinguishing the fire kindled in the apartment of His Majesty's most dear imperial consort, did maliciously, traitorously, and devilishly, by discharge of his urine, put out the said fire kindled in the said apartment, lying and being within the precincts of the said royal palace, against the statute in that case provided, etc., against the duty, etc. Article 2. That the said Quintus Flestrin, having brought the imperial fleet of Blefuscu into the royal port, and being afterwards commanded by His Imperial Majesty to seize all the other ships of the said empire of Blefuscu, and reduce that empire to a province, to be governed by a viceroy from hence, and to destroy and put to death not only all the Bigendian exiles, but likewise all the people of that empire who would not immediately forsake the Bigendian heresy, he, the said Flestrin, like a false traitor against His most auspicious, serene, imperial majesty, did petition to be excused from the said service, upon pretense of unwillingness to force the consciences or destroy the liberties and lives of an innocent people. Article 3. That, whereas certain ambassadors arrived from the court of Blefuscu to sue for peace in His Majesty's court, he, the said Flestrin, did, like a false traitor, aid, abet, comfort, and divert the said ambassadors, although he knew them to be servants to a prince who was lately an open enemy to His Imperial Majesty, and in an open war against His said Majesty. Article 4. That the said Quintus Flestrin, contrary to the duty of a faithful subject, is now preparing to make a voyage to the court and empire of Blefuscu, for which he has received only verbal license from His Imperial Majesty, and under color of the said license, does falsely and traitorously intend to take the said voyage, and thereby to aid, comfort, and abet the Emperor of Blefuscu, so lately an enemy, and in open war with His Imperial Majesty aforesaid. There are some other articles, but these are the most important, of which I have read you an abstract. In the several debates upon this impeachment, it must be confessed that His Majesty gave many marks of his great lenity, often urging the services you had done him and endeavoring to extenuate your crimes. The treasurer and admiral insisted that you should be put to the most painful and ignominious death by setting fire to your house at night, and the general was to attend with 20,000 men armed with poisonous arrows to shoot you on the face and hands. Some of your servants were to have private orders to strew a poisonous juice on your shirts and sheets, which would soon make you tear your own flesh and die in the utmost torture. The general came into the same opinion, so that for a long time there was a majority against you. But His Majesty resolving, if possible, to spare your life, at last brought off the chamberlain. Upon this incident, Redrasol, principal secretary for private affairs, who always approved himself your true friend, was commanded by the emperor to deliver his opinion, which he accordingly did, and therein justified the good thoughts you have of him. He allowed your crimes to be great, but that still there was room for mercy, the most commendable virtue in a prince, and for which His Majesty was so justly celebrated. He said, the friendship between you and him was so well known to the world that perhaps the most honorable board might think him partial. However, in obedience to the command he had received, he would freely offer his sentiments, that if His Majesty, in consideration of your services, and pursuant to his own merciful disposition, would please to spare your life, and only give orders to put out both your eyes, he humbly conceived that by this expedient justice might in some measure be satisfied, and all the world would applaud the lenity of the emperor, as well as the fair and generous proceedings of those who have the honor to be his counselors, that the loss of your eyes would be no impediment to your bodily strength, by which you would still be useful to His Majesty, that blindness is an addition to courage by concealing dangers from us, that the fear you had for your eyes was the greatest difficulty in bringing over the enemy's fleet, and it would be sufficient for you to see by the eyes of the ministers, since the greatest princes do no more. This proposal was received with the utmost disapprobation by the whole board. Bolgolam, the admiral, could not preserve his temper, but rising up in fury, said he wondered how the secretary durst presume to give his opinion for preserving the life of a traitor, that the services you had performed were, by all true reasons of state, the great aggravation of your crimes, that you, who were able to extinguish the fire by discharge of urine in Her Majesty's apartment, which he mentioned with horror, might, at another time, raise an inundation by the same means, to drown the whole palace, and the same strength which enabled you to bring over the enemy's fleet might serve, upon the first discontent, to carry it back, that he had good reasons to think you were a Bigendian in your heart, and as treason begins in the heart, before it appears in overt acts, so he accused you as a traitor on that account, and therefore insisted you should be put to death. The treasurer was of the same opinion. He showed to what straits His Majesty's revenue was reduced by the charge of maintaining you, which would soon grow insupportable, that the secretary's expedient of putting out your eyes was so far from being a remedy against this evil that it would probably increase it, as is manifest from the common practice of blinding some kind of fowls, after which they fed the faster and grew sooner fat, that His Sacred Majesty and the council, who are your judges, were in their own consciences fully convinced of your guilt, which was a sufficient argument to condemn you to death, without the formal proofs required by the strict letter of the law. But His Imperial Majesty, fully determined against capital punishment, was graciously pleased to say that since the council thought the loss of your eyes too easy a censure, some other way may be inflicted hereafter. And your friend the secretary, humbly desiring to be heard again, in answer to what the treasurer had objected, concerning the great charge His Majesty was at in maintaining you, said that His Excellency, who had the sole disposal of the emperor's revenue, might easily provide against that evil by gradually lessening your establishment, by which, for want of sufficient food, you would grow weak and faint, and lose your appetite, and consequently decay and consume in a few months. Neither would the stench of your carcass be then so dangerous when it should become more than half diminished, and immediately upon your death, 5,000 or 6,000 of His Majesty's subjects might, in 2 or 3 days, cut your flesh from your bones, take it away by cartloads, and bury it in distant parts, to prevent infection, leaving the skeleton as a monument of admiration to posterity. Thus, by the great friendship of the secretary, the whole affair was compromised. It was strictly enjoined that the project of starving you by degrees should be kept a secret. But the sentence of putting out your eyes was entered on the books, none dissenting, except Bolgolam the admiral, who, being a creature of the empress, was perpetually instigated by her majesty to insist upon your death, she having borne perpetual malice against you on account of that infamous and illegal method you took to extinguish the fire in her apartment. In 3 days, your friend the secretary will be directed to come to your house and read before you the articles of impeachment, and then to signify the great lenity and favor of his majesty and council, whereby you are only condemned to the loss of your eyes, which his majesty does not question you will gratefully and humbly submit to, and 20 of his majesty's surgeons will attend, in order to see the operation well performed, by discharging very sharp-pointed arrows into the balls of your eyes as you lie on the ground. I leave to your prudence what measures you will take, and to avoid suspicion, I must immediately return in as private a manner as I came. His lordship did so, and I remained alone, under many doubts and perplexities of mind. It was a custom introduced by this prince and his ministry, very different, as I have been assured, from the practice of former times, that after the court had decreed any cruel execution, either to gratify the monarch's resentment or the malice of a favorite, the emperor always made a speech to his whole council, expressing his great lenity and tenderness as qualities known and confessed by all the world. His speech was immediately published throughout the kingdom, nor did anything terrify the people so much as those encomiums on his majesty's mercy, because it was observed that the more these praises were enlarged and insisted on, the more inhuman was the punishment, and the sufferer more innocent. Yet as to myself, I must confess, having never been designed for a courtier, either by my birth or education, I was so ill a judge of things that I could not discover the lenity and favor of his sentence, but conceived it, perhaps erroneously, rather to be rigorous than gentle. I sometimes thought of standing my trial, for, although I could not deny the facts alleged in the several articles, yet I hoped they would admit of some extenuation. But having in my life perused many state trials, which I ever observed to terminate as the judges thought fit to direct, I durst not rely on so dangerous a decision, in so critical a juncture, and against such powerful enemies. Once I was strongly bent upon resistance, for, while I had liberty, the whole strength of that empire could hardly subdue me, and I might easily, with stones, pelt the metropolis to pieces. But I soon rejected that project with horror, by remembering the oath I had made to the emperor, the favors I received from him, and the high title of Nardak he conferred upon me. Neither had I so soon learned the gratitude of courtiers to persuade myself that His Majesty's present severities acquitted me of all past obligations. At last I fixed upon a resolution, for which it is probable I may incur some censure, but not unjustly, for I confess I owe the preserving of my eyes, and consequently my liberty, to my own great rashness and want of experience. Because, if I had then known the nature of princes and ministers, which I have since observed in many other courts, and their methods of treating criminals less obnoxious than myself, I should, with great alacrity and readiness, have submitted to so easy a punishment. But hurried on by the precipitancy of youth, and having His Imperial Majesty's license to pay my attendance upon the Emperor of Blefuscu, I took this opportunity, before the 3 days were elapsed, to send a letter to my friend the secretary, signifying my resolution of setting out that morning for Blefuscu, pursuant to the leave I had got, and without waiting for an answer, I went to that side of the island where our fleet lay. I seized a large man of war, tied a cable to the prow, and lifting up the anchors, I stripped myself, put my clothes, together with my coverlet, which I carried under my arm, into the vessel, and drawing it after me, between wading and swimming, arrived at the royal port of Blefuscu, where the people had long expected me. They lent me 2 guides to direct me to the capital city, which is of the same name. I held them in my hands till I came within 200 yards of the gate, and desired them to signify my arrival to one of the secretaries, and let him know I there waited His Majesty's command. I had the answer in about an hour, that His Majesty, attended by the royal family and great officers of the court, was coming out to receive me. I advanced 100 yards. The Emperor and his train alighted from their horses, the Empress and ladies from their coaches, and I did not perceive they were in any fright or concern. I lay on the ground to kiss His Majesty's and the Empress's hands. I told His Majesty that I was come according to my promise, and with the license of the Emperor, my master, to have the honor of seeing so mighty a monarch, and to offer him any service in my power, consistent with my duty to my own prince, not mentioning a word of my disgrace, because I had hitherto no regular information of it, and might suppose myself wholly ignorant of any such design. Neither could I reasonably conceive that the Emperor would discover the secret, while I was out of his power, wherein, however, it soon appeared I was deceived. I shall not trouble the reader with the particular account of my reception at this court, which was suitable to the generosity of so great a prince, nor of the difficulties I was in, for want of a house or bed, being forced to lie on the ground, wrapped up in my coverlet. Chapter 8. The author, by a lucky accident, finds means to leave Blefuscu, and after some difficulties, returns safe to his native country. 3 days after my arrival, walking out of curiosity to the northeast coast of the island, I observed, about half a league off in the sea, somewhat that looked like a boat overturned. I pulled off my shoes and stockings, and wading 200 or 300 yards, I found the object to approach nearer by force of the tide, and then plainly saw it to be a real boat, which I supposed might by some tempest have been driven from a ship, whereupon I returned immediately towards the city, and desired His Imperial Majesty to lend me 20 of the tallest vessels he had left, after the loss of his fleet and 3,000 seamen under the command of his vice-admiral. This fleet sailed round, while I went back the shortest way to the coast, where I first discovered the boat. I found the tide had driven it still nearer. The seamen were all provided with cordage, which I had beforehand twisted to a sufficient strength. When the ships came up, I stripped myself and waited till I came within 100 yards of the boat, after which I was forced to swim till I got up to it. The seamen threw me the end of the cord, which I fastened to a hole in the forepart of the boat, and the other end to a man of war. But I found all my labor to little purpose, for, being out of my depth, I was not able to work. In this necessity I was forced to swim behind, to push the boat forward, as often as I could, with one of my hands, and the tide favoring me, I advanced so far that I could just hold up my chin and feel the ground. I rested 2 or 3 minutes, and then gave the boat another shove, and so on, till the sea was no higher than my armpits. And now, the most laborious part being over, I took out my other cables, which were stowed in one of the ships, and fastened them first to the boat, and then to 9 of the vessels which attended me. The wind being favorable, the seamen towed and I shoved, until we arrived within 40 yards of the shore, and waiting till the tide was out, I got dry to the boat, and by the assistance of 2,000 men with ropes and engines, I made a shift to turn it on its bottom, and found it was but little damaged. I shall not trouble the reader with the difficulties I was under, by the help of certain paddles, which cost me 10 days of making, to get my boat to the royal port of Blefuscu, where a mighty concourse of people appeared upon my arrival, full of wonder at the sight of so prodigious a vessel. I told the Emperor that my good fortune had thrown this boat in my way, to carry me to some place whence I might return into my native country, and begged His Majesty's orders for getting materials to fit it up, together with his license to depart, which, after some kind of expostulations, he was pleased to grant. I did very much wonder, in all this time, not to have heard of any express relating to me from our Emperor to the court of Blefuscu. But I was afterward given privately to understand that His Imperial Majesty, never imagining I had the least notice of his designs, believed I was only gone to Blefuscu in performance of my promise, according to the license he had given me, which was well known at our court, and would return in a few days, when the ceremony was ended. but he was at last in pain at my long absence, and after consulting with the treasurer and the rest of that cabal, a person of quality was dispatched with a copy of the articles against me. This envoy had instructions to represent to the monarch of Blefuscu the great lenity of his master, who was content to punish me no farther than with the loss of my eyes, that I had fled from justice, and if I did not return in 2 hours, I should be deprived of my title of Nardak, and declared a traitor. The envoy further added that in order to maintain the peace and amity between both empires, his master expected that his brother of Blefuscu would give orders to have me sent back to Lilliput, bound hand and foot, to be punished as a traitor. The emperor of Blefuscu, having taken 3 days to consult, returned an answer consisting of many civilities and excuses. He said that as for sending me bound, his brother knew it was impossible, that although I had deprived him of his fleet, yet he owed great obligations to me for many good offices I had done him in making the peace. That, however, both their majesties would soon be made easy, for I had found a prodigious vessel on the shore, able to carry me on the sea, which he had given orders to fit up, with my own assistance and direction, and he hoped in a few weeks both empires would be freed from so insupportable an encumbrance. With this answer, the envoy returned to Lilliput, and the monarch of Blefuscu related to me all that had passed, offering me at the same time, but under the strictest confidence, his gracious protection, if I would continue in his service, wherein, although I believed him sincere, yet I resolved never more to put any confidence in princes or ministers, where I could possibly avoid it. And therefore, with all due acknowledgments for his favorable intentions, I humbly begged to be excused. I told him that since fortune, whether good or evil, had thrown a vessel in my way, I was resolved to venture myself on the ocean, rather than be an occasion of difference between two such mighty monarchs. Neither did I find the emperor at all displeased, and I discovered, by a certain accident, that he was very glad of my resolution, and so were most of his ministers. These considerations moved me to hasten my departure somewhat sooner than I intended, to which the court, impatient to have me gone, very readily contributed. 500 workmen were employed to make 2 sails to my boat, according to my directions, by quilting 13 folds of their strongest linen together. I was at the pains of making ropes and cables by twisting 10, 20, or 30 of the thickest and strongest of theirs. A great stone that I happened to find, after a long search, by the seashore, served me for an anchor, and I had the tallow of 300 cows for greasing my boat and other uses. I was at incredible pains in cutting down some of the largest timber trees for oars and masts, wherein I was, however, much assisted by His Majesty's ship carpenters, who helped me in smoothing them, after I had done the rough work. In about a month, when all was prepared, I sent to receive His Majesty's commands and to take my leave. The Emperor and royal family came out of the palace. I lay down on my face to kiss his hand, which he very graciously gave me. So did the Empress and young princes of the blood. His Majesty presented me with 50 purses of 200 sprugs apiece, together with his picture at full length, which I put immediately into one of my gloves to keep it from being hurt. The ceremonies at my departure were too many to trouble the reader with at this time. I stored the boat with the carcasses of 100 oxen and 300 sheep, with bread and drink proportionable, and as much meat ready dressed as 400 cooks could provide. I took with me 6 cows and 2 bulls alive, with as many ewes and rams, intending to carry them into my own country, and propagate a breed. And to feed them on board, I had a good bundle of hay and a bag of corn. I would gladly have taken 12 of the natives, but this was a thing the emperor would by no means permit. And besides a diligent search into my pockets, His Majesty engaged my honor not to carry away any of his subjects, although with their own consent and desire. Having thus prepared all things as well as I was able, I set sail on the 24th day of September, 1701, at 6 in the morning, and, when I had gone about 4 leagues to the northward, the wind being at southeast, at 6 in the evening I descried a small island, about 0.5 league to the northwest. I advanced forward, and cast anchor on the lee side of the island, which seemed to be uninhabited. I then took some refreshment and went to my rest. I slept well, and as I conjectured, at least 6 hours, for I found the day broke in 2 hours after I awakened. It was a clear night. I ate my breakfast before the sun was up, and heaving anchor, the wind being favorable, I steered the same course that I had done the day before, wherein I was directed by my pocket compass. My intention was to reach, if possible, one of those islands which I had reason to believe lay to the northeast of Van Diemen's Land. I discovered nothing all that day, but upon the next, about 3 in the afternoon, when I had, by my computation, made 24 leagues from Blefuscu, I descried a sail steering to the southeast. My course was due east. I hailed her, but could get no answer. Yet I found I gained upon her, for the wind slackened. I made all the sail I could, and in half an hour she spied me, then hung out her ancient and discharged a gun. It is not easy to express the joy I was in upon the unexpected hope of once more seeing my beloved country, and the dear pledges I left in it. The ship slackened her sails, and I came up with her between 5 and 6 in the evening, September 26th. But my heart leaped within me to see her English colors. I put my cows and sheep into my coat pockets, and got on board with all my little cargo of provisions. The vessel was an English merchantman, returning from Japan by the North and South Seas. The captain, Mr. John Biddle of Deptford, a very civil man, and an excellent sailor. We were now in the latitude of 30 degrees south. There were about 50 men in the ship, and here I met an old comrade of mine, one Peter Williams, who gave me a good character to the captain. This gentleman treated me with all kindness, and desired I would let him know what place I came from last, and whither I was bound, which I did in a few words. But he thought I was raving, and that the dangers I underwent had disturbed my head. Whereupon, I took my black cattle and sheep out of my pocket, which, after great astonishment, clearly convinced him of my veracity. I then showed him the gold given me by the Emperor of Blefuscu, together with His Majesty's picture at full length, and some other rarities of that country. I gave him 2 purses of 200 sprugs each, and promised, when we arrived in England, to make him a present of a cow and a sheep big with young. I shall not trouble the reader with a particular account of this voyage, which was very prosperous for the most part. We arrived in the Downs on the 13th of April, 1702. I had only one misfortune, that the rats on board carried away one of my sheep. I found her bones in a hole, picked clean from the flesh. The rest of my cattle I got safe ashore, and set them a-grazing in a bowling green at Greenwich, where the fineness of the grass made them feed very heartily, though I had always feared the contrary. Neither could I possibly have preserved them in so long a voyage, if the captain had not allowed me some of his best biscuit, which, rubbed to powder and mingled with water, was their constant food. The short time I continued in England, I made a considerable profit by showing my cattle to many persons of quality and others, and before I began my second voyage, I sold them for £600. Since my last return, I find the breed is considerably increased, especially the sheep, which I hope will prove much to the advantage of the woolen manufacture, by the fineness of the fleeces. I stayed but 2 months with my wife and family, for my insatiable desire of seeing foreign countries would soon suffer me to continue no longer. I left £1,500 with my wife, and fixed her in a good house at Redriff. My remaining stock I carried with me, part in money and part in goods, in hopes to improve my fortunes. My eldest uncle John had left me an estate in land near Epping, of about £30 a year, and I had a long lease of the Black Bull in Fetter Lane, which yielded me as much more, so that I was not in any danger of leaving my family upon the parish. My son Johnny, named so after his uncle, was at the grammar school, and a towardly child. My daughter Betty, who is now well married and has 2 children, was then at her needlework. I took leave of my wife and boy and girl, with tears on both sides, and went on board the Adventure, a merchant ship of 300 tons bound for Surat, Captain John Nicholas of Liverpool, commander. But my account of this voyage must be referred to the second part of my travels. This is B.J. Harrison. I hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of A Voyage to Lilliput, Part 3 of 3, from Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. If you've enjoyed this episode, please become a supporter by going to ClassicTalesAudiobooks.com. Donate $5 a month and get a monthly coupon code for $8 off any audiobook order. Thanks for pitching in. Thank you for joining me today and allowing classic literature to awaken your better self. Please join me next time, and we'll rediscover the greatest stories ever put to paper.